Zoom in on global affairs with insightful debates and exclusive interviews. This is World Insight.
Hello, I'm Tian Wei, and welcome to World Insight. The China Development Forum 2024 wrapped up. It is one platform for leading figures of global companies to interact with Chinese government leaders and policymakers. Chinese Premier Li Qiang addressed his audience at the opening ceremony about opportunities to invest in China.
Despite external pressure and internal difficulties, we successfully accomplished the main targets and tasks of economic and social development this year. Economic recovery continued to strengthen, and new industries, new models, and new drivers of growth accelerated.
Among those in the audience, leading business figures from the U.S., 4 months after the San Francisco meeting between Chinese and the U.S. presidents. So what is the state of the relations now in a year when the world is watching very closely the U.S. election? How are business leaders digesting the changes and keeping trade and investment vibrant? My exclusive interview with Steve Ordians, president of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. Mr. Ordians, this time you are also seeing a larger group of American business community representatives coming to Beijing for the upcoming China Development Forum, for example. What are some of the messages you are getting from them? What do you think they are trying to convey here?
Well, I think they're trying to learn. There's great concern in the U.S. business community about China's economy, about the investment environment, about should they be expanding. These are most of the companies that are coming are already here. They're not companies that are considering coming to China. They're already here in a big way, and they need to decide, do I want to increase investment? So they need to hear from the senior levels of the Chinese government. What are they going to do to deal with some of the issues that foreign businesses are confronting? What is the future of the Chinese economy? What levels of growth are we going to see? What levels of consumer spending? So they're really coming to understand rather than convey a message.
I understand that there are some kinds of surveillance even toward the American business community about their investment in China. Going on in Washington, D.C., at least discussions about that. So how do you see the best way for them, I mean the American business community, to figure out to address this divide between China and the U.S. when it comes to the government?
I think they need to speak out. I think businesses need to say, this is what is national security. What we do, maybe there's a tiny percentage of the companies that really touch on national security, but the overwhelming majority don't. And when the government asks them about their investment, they say, we think this is good for the company. We think it's good for America. One of the issues that's kind of become more salient over these years is people think investment in China is bad for America. Investment in China is good for America. It's good for American employment. It's good for American businesses. And what it does, and what I love to talk about, is how investment builds people-to-people bridges. I've always said trade is kind of like dating. You know, you sell, you kind of go home, you come back next year, maybe you have another date, maybe you don't. Investment is marriage. When you've put money, when a Chinese company puts money in the United States, when a U.S. company puts money in China, they are married to that. They have to figure out a way to make it work. And what I've noticed over these 45 years is the areas where Chinese invest in the United States, where Americans invest in China, are more pro-constructive engagement than other areas, because they've dealt with Americans, or in America, they dealt with Chinese. So investment flows are very important for the people-to-people bridges that they build.
Many of these companies are actually quite concerned about the political rhetorics against them. For example, TikTok is a latest case study. Many are watching very closely. Your take on that?
TikTok, you know, is a reflection of how difficult U.S.-China relations can be. From virtually in 7 days, the Congress, the House of Representatives, created a bill, and suddenly it passed the House in literally less than 7 days from when it was conceptualized, written, came out of committee and then was passed by the Congress with only 65 votes against it. TikTok has put in place something called the Texas Project, which protects data of TikTok users better than any other social media company in the world. They have spent $1.5 billion. In my view, if the U.S. government wants to regulate social media companies, they want to regulate Facebook, if they want to regulate YouTube, mm-hmm. they want to regulate TikTok, they can do that, but then they should regulate them all the same. It should be a level playing field. Mm-hmm. So that this happened so quick was disconcerting, I think. It's troubling. I don't know what the Senate, obviously the bill has passed the House of Representatives. Right. We will see what the Senate does. It's certainly going to be a much slower process. And even, so the bill requires a sale within 6 months. And if the sale doesn't occur to an American buyer, then TikTok will be banned. That will, even if the bill passed, the U.S. System, TikTok will sue to enjoin the enforcement of that law. And given the free speech issues that will arise, my expectation would be that a court would enjoin the enforcement of the law. Mm. So it will be a long process, but it still is a reflection of how difficult the U.S.-China relationship is.
Meanwhile, we also see interesting interactions between China and the United States on artificial intelligence, for example. Lately, the United Nations passed a document which parties joining the document call on gave governance on artificial intelligence. The U.S. initiated it and many others followed, including China also signed on it. Of course, it does not necessarily have legal responsibility part as a resolution, but it does show an interesting example of cooperation between China and the United States, even concerning artificial intelligence. What is your take on examples like this?
Artificial intelligence is one of the areas that has been raised at the government level, and there seems to be a consensus developing that the United States and China should talk about it on a track one level, government to government, and also on a track two level, that discussions of AI between think tanks, between academics, and between government are now on the increase, and we're beginning to see that. And the UN is a reflection, that document is a reflection of everyone's understanding that we need to figure out what to do about AI. Similarly, we came close in Woodside, in California, when President Xi met with President Biden, to reaching an agreement kind of on how AI is used in military application. I think the both sides agree. I think actually everyone agrees we need to put humans in the chain. We can't have AI just launching weapons. And I think the Chinese military, the U.S. military all agree on that. I think we just need to agree on the language, and that will be a positive thing for the world and for U.S.-China relations and for others who are working on AI. So, you know, what, you know, I think back to our interview in last year at the CDF and how literally the governments weren't talking. But now we've seen, right after that, we saw a path to San Francisco. So after Wang Yi and Jake Sullivan met in Vienna, they laid out kind of a path to having Xi Jinping and President Biden meet at Woodside in San Francisco. And it worked. So we're now seeing increased discussions at the government-to-government level. We're seeing the establishment of working groups. We're seeing mill-to-mill contact. We're seeing fewer confrontations on the military side. So we've actually, in that 12 months, we've seen significant progress. 1 month, there was no progress. But then after that, we've really had obviously, it's not where I want U.S.-China relations to be. You know, I want a cooperative relationship that helps the peoples of both countries. And we're not there, but we're at least off of the bottom where we were.
semiconductors, for example, that the U.S. companies produce can sell to the Chinese market. Now, according to the latest rule from the U.S., it's limited in terms of the sophistication and the levels. So is this going to be a constructive move by the U.S. side? Shouldn't they be speaking out against this?
What we need is both sides to sit down and agree on a definition of what is national security. So not all AI relates to national security. Some does. Not all chips relate to national security. You know, some of it is for cancer research. Some of it, I mean, there's so many things, so many good things that it can affect. So we need, at a senior level, both sides to sit down and say, this is national security, and also at the same time say, this is whitelisted. This is stuff, I mean, stuff on climate change. We don't want to be limiting an interchange of either ideas or equipment that can help with climate change. That certainly is not a good thing. But what's happened now is both sides have kind of let national security expand. And it's expanded to the point where it really hurts the average Chinese and the average American. And that's kind of why I continue in my job, because I believe that we need to take care of the peoples of China and the peoples of the United States, and a good, constructive relationship between the United States and China does that.
How do you see the efficiency of discussions, as you just mentioned, about not letting national security becoming overblown into every topic? How efficient can the two governments conduct conversations like this?
You know, so Secretary,
where are we now?
Secretary Raimondo has come here and explained why these regulations are there, trying to get understanding in both Chinese business and Chinese government of why we have put in place those restrictions. And when there is an objection, she obviously doesn't on the spot agree to change it, but then there's discussion within the U.S. government. The U.S. government doesn't want China's economy to fail. They want China's economy to succeed. We still should work on the concept of what are the real threats to the Chinese people and the American people. Today we saw, you know, a horrible mass murder in Moscow by terrorists. That, to me, should remind everybody that terrorism is a real threat. It's a, you know, it's a threat in the United States, it's a threat in Russia, it's a threat in China, and we need to cooperate on that. Climate change is a real threat, and that could be the greatest threat that we're currently facing. But to engage in what I call threat inflation, to say, the United States is going to do this to China, or China is going to do this to the United States, it's not good. Because what that does, it creates a misallocation of resources. So instead of using the money to rebuild infrastructure or for education or for poverty alleviation, we use it to build fighters. We use it to build anti-aircraft guns, to build more ships, things which don't have the social benefit that infrastructure, education, poverty alleviation would have. So I will keep fighting for that, but I recognize that I'm a minority, political minority.
But a very strong-minded minority. We see the extension of this cooperation agreement between China and U.S. In science and technology.
Very quietly.
But it is happening.
Yes.
So how do we interpret the apparent quietness of positive development, if I could use this general adjective, vis-a-vis the noise and the rhetorics related to some of the areas that seem to be blown out of proportion, the issue of national security?
Well, I think a positive development in the United States, if you're a politician, you will be attacked. No matter if it benefits the American people, nobody cares. You'll be attacked as being, quote, soft on China. So, you know, to draw a lot of publicity to it is not considered a good thing. In China, similarly, if you're doing stuff that is good for the Chinese people, but it's viewed as pro-American, you're attacked as being the love America faction. So that's not good. So both sides have this unhelpful view of when they're positive developments, we can't really talk about them because you're going to be attacked. My view is no. I talk about the President Xi, President Biden agreements in Woodside all the time. You know, when people say that we shouldn't have hosted the dinner, people say we shouldn't have hosted the dinner.
Well,
for
you are
President
accused
Xi.
In the media reports. And I mean, also,
it's absurd. Of course we should do. I mean, it's seriously the president. Every president of China who set foot in the United States, the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations has hosted an event for them, a dinner or a lunch for them. And it's a good thing. It gives the president an opportunity to a platform to talk directly to the
American
people.
And by the way,
that's
your job, isn't it?
Of course, but then I say, you know, the fentanyl agreement, that's just one of the agreements, but the fentanyl agreement. So you say that President Biden and President Xi, you attacking me and others, say President Biden and President Xi shouldn't have done that, shouldn't have met. I said, tell it to the parents of a kid who did not die of a fentanyl overdose, that because of what China did as a result of those discussions, American lives are being saved. So I'm perfectly happy to say, you know, that's a great thing. Pandas coming back to the United States is a great thing. Having more government-to-government meetings is a great thing. So I'm very comfortable with hosting Chinese leaders when they come to the United States. And what we're seeing now in the last several months is more Chinese leaders coming to the United States. Now, there's rarely a week or two that doesn't go by when we don't have a senior Chinese leader. So the vice governor of Shandong was in New York. The party secretary of Guizhou, the mayor of Shanghai is coming. You know, all of these, and this is great because then the American people, the American business community can hear directly from Chinese officials and others what is happening in China.
You saw the honeymoon time and you certainly experienced the downhill time. And now we are seeing some kinds of very gradual recovery or reasoning period of time. So how are you trying to adjust yourself, you know, with all of these different winds coming to different directions?
I still think we're in for a difficult time. I think that the environment in both countries are not conducive to having major breakthroughs in U.S.-China relations. So we're kind of prepared. You know, I'm very pleased at the progress, but I'm also concerned that this progress could stop. There could be some incident somewhere, who knows where, that could derail the relationship again, because, you know, there's not a huge amount of trust and friendship. The days when there was tons of people who were friends of the Chinese leadership or Chinese who were friends of the American leadership are past. So, and to kind of argue for this relationship within the United States is not generally a great thing to do if you're a politician. Similarly, within China, we have problems if you're advocating too strongly for a good relationship with the United States. But having said that, I've seen a lot of friends. I will see more over the next few days, and it heartens me because in the end, a constructive U.S.-China relationship benefits the Chinese people and it benefits the American people. And when I see my friends, I know that they remember that and I remember that. So I want to spend more time in China.
And they're working with you?
Yes. I mean, we don't agree. There are times, you know, there are lots of issues we don't agree on. And it's okay. We're still friends. I mean, you can have a spouse and not agree with your spouse on issues. Doesn't mean you get divorced. It means you work through it, you understand the differences, and there are lots of differences.
You talk about people to people a lot, and now we see that is taking place, the people to people interactions going on. But to what extent do you hope it can still be able to soar, at least before the U.S. election?
We've seen progress. We've seen an increase in the number of American students that are here. You know, the Chinese students going to the United States seems to have stabilized. It was dropping, you know, went from 400,000 down to probably closer to 285,000. But that now seems to be stabilizing and picking up again. The Chinese government has very wisely simplified the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has simplified the visa application. It was very complicated, very intrusive. Now it's better. You know, they've granted Europeans visa-free entry. They're moving towards visa-free entry for Shanghai, for Hainan, for other places. That's all beneficial. The 50,000 American students that President Xi wants to come to China over the next 5 years is great. Now, the Chinese government is now beginning to implement it. So I've met delegations from China. They're saying, okay, you know, we'll go to this high school, we'll invite these people, we'll go to this college, and they're contacting colleges. And that's all important because I think we need Americans to come here. Because I remember in one of your interviews, there was a little note at the bottom, and it said, where's the next
yes.
Orleans?
Indeed.
And that's unless you have lived in China, unless you've reached a level of fluency that's really almost native, it's really hard to kind of understand U.S.-China relations, understand the Chinese view, understand the United States. So that's but we're beginning to see progress. I mean, the State Department needs to, the U.S. and Chinese government need to talk about, there's what's called a level 3 travel advisory about Americans coming to China, which means if you're thinking of coming, it says reconsider coming. Well, that's wrong. But there are issues, you know, I think the U.S. government believes there are exit bans on certain Americans. They can't leave China. And until that's resolved, they won't take the level 3 and move it to a more reasonable level 2. Well, the two governments should be able to sit down and work that out. If I were in one government or the other, I could probably fix that in an hour. Well, of course, my Chinese friends old joke, if you were in the government, U.S.-China relations would be quite different.
We earlier heard words like decoupling a lot, invented by politicians.
Yeah.
And now
you're not hearing it much anymore.
We're not hearing it much anymore. Does it mean it has failed? Hyping about it at least has failed.
Well, you know, it's now about de-risking. You know, it means that you have to make your supply chain resilient enough that if something happens, you're still going to be able to stay in business, as opposed to completely decouple from your suppliers in China. But it's was never a sensible idea. Our two economies are far too intertwined to have this, quote, decoupling. Have U.S. businesses de-risked? They have to a certain degree. If you were using China as a base for exporting back to the United States, it's very likely you have now diversified your production sources to, you know, Vietnam or to Cambodia or to Malaysia, Indonesia, somewhere else where you're not solely dependent on China. That's okay. I'm okay with that. I'm not okay with the concept of decoupling. The cost to Chinese and American people is far too high.
Finally, before we go, what advice would you provide for those people who want to be realistic, but at the same time still remain hopeful of a more reasonable China-U.S. relationship?
Speak out. You know, figure out what is right. You know, if you're Chinese, figure out what's right for the Chinese people and speak out about it. If you're an American, speak out about it. You know, figure it out. Do it based upon facts. Do it based upon data and talk about it, whether it's talk to the media, talk to the government, so that we have out there solutions which can make the relationship better. When there's no conversation, when everybody says the government is fine, everything they're doing is fine, that makes it actually more difficult to make progress. So my view is speak out. And I know sometimes that's difficult, but, you know, as the quote which got me very famous in China, you know, the end of that quote is, "Tigao woman de yongqi," be brave, you know, be courageous. It's important that we all be brave and courageous, and sometimes we need to make sacrifices. But certainly, that's what we at the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations are prepared to do.
Steve Ordens, President of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. Thank you so much, sir. And that's all the time we have for today. I'm Tian Wei on behalf of my team. Thanks for being with us. Bye for now.
Dive into news like never before with Deep Dive, the podcast from CGTN Radio. join our global reporters for captivating stories and thought-provoking conversations. Search Deep Dive on your favorite podcast platforms and get ready to dive in.